Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Drew Kaplan, and we are going to be talking about Stam Yainam. Yes, this is another wine-oriented episode in our lead-up to the holiday of Purim. Rabbi Drew Kaplan has been advancing and enhancing knowledge around the Jewish drinking experience for years through his Jewish Drinking Project. In addition to writing, speaking, and more on this topic, he has also published over 150 episodes of the Jewish Drinking Show, as well as running the world's number one website on Jewish drinking wisdom, history, and more, JewishDrinking.com, for over 4.5 years. A self-proclaimed beer geek, he considers himself a pluralist when it comes to beverages. He enjoys sharing knowledge and enjoyment of all beverages that elevate lives. Having graduated rabbinical school a decade and a half ago, he has professionally worked with college students and young adults in Southern California, seniors in Cincinnati, and more. He resides in Cincinnati with his wife and four children. And Rabbi Kaplan, it is a real privilege and joy to have someone with your area of expertise and specialty to talk about this topic of wine. And we're not just talking about wine, but we're going to be talking about what is, I think, a quasi-famous tshuva or an iconic tshuva of the Rama. This is going to be one of our, we're doing a back-to-back, actually. We're going to have two Siman, Kuf Chav Dalet and Kuf Chav Hey, right next to each other on the podcast. I would say it's by coincidence. Maybe it's Hashgacha Pratis, whatever it might be. So anyway, why don't you first tell our audience a little bit about Stam Yainam, and then we're going to get to this magnificent tshuva of the Rama on the matter.
Absolutely. So for background context, so wine is a really special beverage in Judaism. I actually like to call it the chosen beverage of the chosen people. And on account of that, it attains a special status. It has its own special blessing for it, red being the only other consumable item that has a distinct blessing for it. So there's a lot of special stuff around it. And the background behind thinking about wine is, one, there was not even talking about Stam Yainam, which literally just means like their normal wine. Setting aside normal wine, Gentile wine itself in the sages, Second Temple time, was off limits. And the main primary concern was libation. Was it libated to idolatrous worship? That was the key concern. However, there was a secondary concern, which, as the Talmud records in Avodah Zarah 36b, actually it was specifically Bale quoting Avimi Nota, who indirectly quoted Rav, that it was one of the 18 decrees of Shammai's Academy. So for those keeping score at home, Avodah Zarah 36b. And it pops up. It's certainly in the second chapter of Mishnah Avodah Zarah. And as a matter of fact, a fun trivia piece for wine. This is a good kiddish trivia, by the way. The tractate of the Mishnah in which wine appears the most frequently is Avodah Zarah. And then like a distant second is Trumot, and Brachot isn't even like till number 5 on the tractates that have the most mentions of wine in the Mishnah. So it is a key concern. And the actually surprising thing is really chapters 4 and 5 are the primary areas where wine is discussed a lot in Mishnah Avodah Zarah. But chapter 2 and a lot of the Talmudic conversation around these issues and matters really are in that second chapter. So if anybody would like to do a deeper dive for that, but this is a Teshuvah show and not a Talmud show. So we're going to get back to the topic. So Stam Yainam, and I mentioned the Talmudic background. Yeah, it's a concern. And you know, as I mentioned in that Talmudic stuff, but it's not only in 36b, it's, you know, 29b, especially if anybody really wants to dive more deeply, 30, 31, roughly, in Avodah Zarah, the conversation really is about intermarriage. The concern around Gentile wine isn't so much about idolatrous worship, even just in general. Like, what if they, you know, by drinking with them, or maybe you go to their house and you typically or regularly consume wine with the, you know, people just make wine at home. You'll develop a closer familiarity with both them and ultimately intermarry. So that was really sort of the concern. Now, there are two aspects. It's not only the drinking, but even in Talmudic times, it was also to engage commercially with it. So the language is around hana, benefit, but it was more of an economic / commercial aspect of benefit. But medieval, you know, Middle Ages roll around, and look, just libation is just not so, it's not such a top, it's just, that's not really what the Gentiles are doing in Christianity. Aside from, yes, I know, you know, you have the Catholic Church and they're engaged within a certain context in church. But aside from that, by and large, it's not yet, you know, there still is sort of the general prohibition. And ultimately, I mean, something we're going to touch upon here is even the commerce aspect, it becomes loosened. And it becomes this thing where, you know what, in Ashkenaz, wine was all over. Certainly, even just for general commercial aspects, or even what about relieving debts owned, which was not such a huge issue for. So Rabbi Yisraelis is very famous and well known for his mappah, his tablecloth on the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Cairo. Rabbi Cairo was living in Sephardic lands, and the Gentiles around him were Muslims. So they didn't really, wine was not a big part of their lives. And so it really wasn't an issue. But Rabbi Yisraelis living in Ashkenazi lands, wine was definitely around. And it was something that on a just sort of a typical, even just a general, even a more common commercial level, people were engaged in it, even just, as I mentioned, repaying debt. So it became something, I think we'll get into a little bit later, but it became really common and was sort of all around. So they sort of permitted even just sort of the commercial aspects, but still retained this prohibition against drinking
Gentile wine. So just to review a little bit. So it sounds like there's this fundamental issue of Yayin Nesech, which is if we see that a priest of some religion takes this wine and consecrates it, clearly there's no matter of dispute. Unambiguously, this is problematic. Then came along the sages and they said, even Stam Yayinim, even wine that we do not know to have been explicitly consecrated, but is being poured and handled and touched by non-Jews. So even that is problematic, either because maybe, who knows, maybe they did want to consecrate it. Or number two, it just because we need some way of creating a social barrier between Jews and non-Jews, and drinking together is just going to lead to not mixed dancing in the gender sense, but maybe in the religious sense is what we're concerned for.
I mean, alcohol is a social lubricant and it can be also a sexual lubricant. So it can, you know, just sort of facilitating such relations. And there's another aspect I think that makes everything really confusing, which is even just simply a Gentile's touch of non-cooked wine, which is a whole separate topic. But even that, which seems to be more from the realm of the libation aspect, but it comes into the topic even to some degree of just sort of general Gentile wine. But
right. And we're not going to talk about that issue.
We're not.
What about certain Jews? If certain Jews handling wine, that could be problematic as well based on their observance. But I imagined we're not going to go down that route now. What we want to get to rather
those are other teshuvot.
Those are other tshuvas, yes. But our tshuva is this really fascinating tshuva of the Rama. I mean, I have the tshuva in front of me. And what kind of struck me right off the bat is literally the introduction. He opens up, Ezri b'shem Hashem, oseh shamayim v'aretz, v'hu yatzi lady mishkia. You could tell he's kind of trembling as he's writing this tshuva. You know, God save me from saying anything wrong. He quotes, I think it's Yochanan ben Zakkai and Bava Basra. He's saying it's a matter of Oilim Omro, Oilim Lo Omro, damned if you do, damned if you don't. If I say something, they'll shoot me. If I don't say something, I can't bear that as well. And so what exactly is the problem that the Rama is facing that he's trembling as he writes this tshuva?
All right. I like your languages. It's a Tanayetic catch 22. So the question, as it's simply posed to him, is someone asks, look, I see those Jews over in Moravia, and there's some other lands that they drink Gentile wine. And he just wants to know, is there any way that is there a fundamental halachic basis that they can in any way rely upon? Now, that's really it as it's stated. However, and the questioner clearly knows that this is a problem. At the same time, that seems to be it. Yet, as you point out, Rabbi Yisraelis knows, he worries that if he can't just ignore this because it could become worse, but he's also worried, he knows that answering it could be problematic. And so he states at the outset, there's really two motivations. The first one is he's worried that what about these transgressors? He says, if I do say it, that maybe these transgressors will mislearn it, misread it, and just continue to further transgress. The other thing is, what happens if I don't say anything? Maybe that, you know, what about they could just become further problematic.
I think there's an issue ways. Of, you know, what happens to the manos, what happens to the status of these people who seem to be outright sinning.
Well, that's the next step. So then he not the questioner, Rabbi Yisraelis throws in sort of upping the stakes. It's not just simply answering, but he says, wait a second. He knows that he like feels the charge. He is personally tasked with this. He says, Ki tov limso k'tzas tam amikamo shenagu la'kebo, v'shol yeh kulam chashudim be'ini habriyos. So he's worried that now there are stakes. What about, as you mentioned, the ne'emanus? What about trustworthiness? What about engaging commercially or other documents or testimonies? So now there is something at stake beyond their own personal consumption. There are broader societal, civil concerns that he knows that he now needs to address, even for those other Jews who still pay attention to these rules.
And so what he's about to do is, he's about to do what many poskim have to do, is that they embark on a journey of a limud schus. Mm-hmm. He sees that there's so many Jews doing something. I think at some point toward the beginning, he even quotes the line, "Im eina neviim b'nei b'neim shel neviim heim." So, well, on the one hand,
what? And the parentheses after that is hilarious.
Oh, do tell.
He says, "Oh, Navi Sheker." Even though he says, "Neviim b'neihem shal neviim," he says, "Oh, Navi Sheker." Maybe they could just be totally off.
I wonder if this is not in my version that I'm using. I know there were censorship issues with this tshuva, weren't there?
Yeah, so we can't ignore it. I will say this is perhaps one of the most famous instances of internal Orthodox remove censorship. And this actually becomes, I will mention this again, but Dr. Mark Shapiro writes about this in his book. This becomes one of, this isn't, I would say perhaps amongst Tshuva, this is like the most famous one, especially because he's not an obscure rabbi. Like, he is a really well-known throughout the entire history of, you know, rabbinic authors. This is, he's a major guy, and to just remove him in certain editions, not all editions. And the, Professor Rabbi Dr. Asher Siv, who wrote his doctoral dissertation at YU and also got smicha from Reitz, he republished these teshuvot, including specifically this one. There are many editions out there that have this just totally, and it goes straight from 123. There's just this weird blank space and then 125.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's funny because the next tshuva, I reference how we're having back-to-back episodes of Tshuva of the Ramah, Kuf Chav Hei, which deals with his controversial Psak Du Kiddushin on Shabbos, B'Shas Adchak. I don't know. I would think that also is, for the same reason someone might want to censor this, I feel like the same people inclined to censor might want to censor that. So it's kind of funny that this tshuva was the one that ultimately got censored out of many editions.
Yeah. I wonder also if there was a specific desire to put them in the middle, because if it's at the end, it can just get chopped off. Right? But putting in the middle makes it harder to excise. At the same time, I kind of think that that's also indirectly a drinking tshuva 125. But
Well, there
you're drinking at the chuppah. It's a Friday night wedding. How could you not drink?
At the chuppah, also there's the wine. So right, plus Friday night as well. Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, there's lots of drinking going on.
Now, wine is involved in everything. Apparently,
absolutely. So yeah. So, but the other thing he throws in that line, and he comes back again. If Rav Mashal Su Avos saying that maybe they just saw what their forefathers were doing, whether in Moravia or elsewhere, that this is a practice that they engaged in. Maybe not necessarily knowingly, but this is just what they do. They're not going out of their way to try to transgress and be different.
This is like eating dairy out. You know, it's like people aren't deliberately trying to violate the Torah. This is just something that has been kind of accepted within their community. They drink Stam Yenam. They don't give a second thought about it. They don't think that they're, you know, that they're veering from observance by doing this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So he starts digging in, there's a lot to go through. But one very, very, very key line, he says, "Keep his man hazeh nowadays in isur hana b'maga kuti." He says, "There's no touching off limitness by Gentiles kiyachshav in regul nasech lavodos elilim with regards to the idolatrous worship aspect." V'chashivim keinyo diem b'tiv avodazar. So he says they don't really know. And then continues on. V'alzeh anusumchin libot yinam b'chovot. Now this is what we rely upon for discharging debts, and this is something that. And now I know that this tshuva is not particularly well known, but something that might be more well known is his mappah in Yoredeya, in the Shulchan Aruch. So this is 123a. So he has this nice little paragraph of basically discussing this whole thing also. Like, he goes a little bit more in depth. He talks about how, you know, that might have been now, then he says, you know, it's funny, the move he makes, and I know we're talking about Shuvo, but this is his Shulchan Aruch writing. He says, you know, like, you can discharge debts this way if you, you know, this is sort of bitty Evan. But then he goes, he's like, and V'yesh Mekilin, there are some who are lenient and allow you even l'chachila to engage commercially. But at the same time, like, he knows that people probably are engaging and will engage commercially. So it's not just simply sort of if that's the way that you need to discharge these debts with regards to the Gentiles. But so this is this. And by the way, for readers who don't just stick to Shuvot literature. And as you see, not only in 123, there's some interesting stuff in 124 and on. And there's, for people who are interested in this whole topic, 124, 25, and it continues. There are just multiple simanim in Yoredeya that goes on and on about wine. And Rabbi Yisrael very clearly takes a different approach to these matters than Rabbi Cairo. But this is a significant aspect. He now allows this piece of it.
Right, so Tosos kind of already begins to chip away at the severity of Stam Yinam.
Yeah.
Until now, we always assumed, similar to Yain Nesech, there wasn't just an isser of shtia, of drinking and consuming it, but there was an isser of hana, of benefiting. So Tosos is already whittling it down a little bit, saying that, you know, because other than perhaps the Catholic Church and some very limited circumstances, people weren't walking around libating every wine that they touched. So maybe he's saying, once we could whittle it down to just an isser of shtia, maybe it's not as huge of a jump to continue being matir somewhat. Is that what he's saying?
Yeah, I mean, the direct quote, he says, Natir Behana Kevan Shigazar al Stam Yinim Shum Beno Seyam. They decreed about their daughters, Hagam Atashay Zed Hatam. This now is the relevant reason that it remains off limits.
Mm.
That's his quoting of Tosfos, and he mentions a bunch of other Rishonim in these matters. And so ultimately, a little bit later down, he says, look, we got rid of the Avodah Zarah concerns, and really just now matters about Benos Ahem. That seems to be that's what's remaining as the central concern. And you can't get rid of it. I mean, even if we think about nowadays, like, there's lots of intermarriage for Jews. I don't know if wine is necessarily caused, but it never goes away, this reasoning. But what he does do, and this is actually really fascinating, he talks about how there's also other consumable items, foods, whether they're vegetables, bread, and different things that are also, they have decrees upon them to block off intermarriage. And he notes that certain aspects, like he mentions bread, which is really, I think it's the beginning of Yoredeya, where Rabbi Cairo has this very strict approach when it comes to Gentile bread. And then Rabbi Yisrael has these huge leniencies amongst Ashkenaz. So he mentions that, and he like tries to provide some sort of, it's funny. It's like this textual outlet that might provide room for it. And we're all reading this. I think anybody who comes across and reads this says, like, I don't think that that's what these wine drinkers are thinking about, but he's like, he's really trying in like sort of this textual approach. I will say one of the pieces he includes, which is for me, I'm not saying for all readers of this teshuva, for me, the most shocking aspect he throws in is he says, that these keni pashe lahem heter heni heyeno bimkomo shenahagu lahakel bimni chay nefesh. He says, maybe this permissibility of drinking their wines in all these different places that they have this leniency to consume Gentile wine is on account of, now this, I love this language of chay nefesh. This is just so essential to people's lives. He says, shahari ein lahem lishtot kim yeno. Now that is shocking to me. Now he lives in Krakow. It is Poland. They drink a lot of beer in Poland, and he knows that. However, what he does not know is he doesn't know what they have out there in Moravia or even these other unnamed lands. Maybe they don't have the same access to beers. He doesn't know. And so it's not like he can look it up in the encyclopedia, right? He doesn't have that access. What we do have is access to these things. And now I know this is three centuries later, but this is the birthplace of, it has Pilsen. They have Pilsners. They have a long-standing beer culture. In fact, going at least back, I mean, documented 6th century, probably 5th century, who knows, even so, at least for a millennium before this, they are a huge beer culture. And so people are drinking, and I don't remember which one is which, but they're drinking hundreds of liters per person per year of beer. Okay, so this is not, you know, something they drink socially. This is a common staple in people's lives. Actually, just throwing in something about the Polish context. I know there's a century later, the Taz, and I know we're a shoot-based podcast here, but
you're allowed to quote other Torah sources. It's mutter.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. Thank you for that leniency. So the Taz, Rabbi David Olivi Siegel, a century later, also living in Poland. So one of the fascinating things, and I this is again, Yoredea, not well known with Chadash. So these Polish rabbis were trying to come up with these leniencies to permit Chadash, and even his father-in-law, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, the new house by Chadash, he tried to come up with some sort of leniency. Taz, his son-in-law, was not happy with that. But really fascinating, this is a great drinking text. He says, we have to permit Chadash here because beer is the, it's man's life. Wow. It's super important. And if you weren't clear on that, he repeats that and he doubles down on that. He says, beer is just so important for us Polish Jews. We need it. And I know it's a century. Yeah. And that's a century after the Rabbi Yisraelis. So I don't know if that holds for this time, but certainly Rabbi Yisraelis understands that beverages are important. Alcohol beverages are important. Obviously, he doesn't know that even Moravia and other lands, beer is also an important and essential beverage. But he,
it's just if I may, it's just such a hard concept for me to wrap my head around. I mean, look, I love a good lagavulin in Shabbos morning as much as the next person, mm-hmm. but I could go, you know, I will survive if I just drink my water and drink my seltzer. Mm-hmm. You know, he makes this comparison to bread. And I understand the centrality of bread in one's diet. And that's why there is this leniency that even though we have a concept of Bishul Akum and we have mm-hmm. all these prohibitions around non-Jews making things, there's many who are lenient for pas palter, for bread that's made in a bakery by a guy. Of course, under some, hopefully, general supervision of a Jew. But you don't need a Jew going in and turning on the ovens every day to fire it up for the baker. So mm-hmm. the reason there is because that is considered chaye nefesh. So he's trying to argue that whether it be wine in our case or whether it be beer in the other case that you referenced, mm-hmm. that these things are kihim chayenu v'ayrech yemenu. Maybe I'm just not understanding the historical context well enough, but I mean, I enjoy a good lagavulin, but I would ultimately survive if I didn't have to drink one.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is the potability of water in those days. And I don't know if this is everything, but certainly a significant piece of it, their water wasn't the best. And so a way to potabilize it is to add alcohol. So whether it's he's allowing for wine or he knows in Poland they drink a lot of beer, they need some way to consume these liquids. Mm. At the same time, like, I don't know, maybe we have just such a peculiar perspective coming from the 21st century and looking at these texts and not understanding how could they have consumed so much alcohol on a, not weekly, a daily basis. It does strike us as strange, peculiar, hard to understand. And yet, was part of
right. I guess,
life.
I guess, you know, when you didn't have easy access to purified water, mm-hmm. These may have been better sources in some way.
Yeah.
I think there's our listeners, you could comment on the Spotify, let us know where the pasuk is. I think it's somewhere in Eicha in which the children, they're crying for yayin actually, mm-hmm. to drink wine. Like, why are you giving children alcohol? Even maybe I'm thinking anachronistically over here, but I think with the limit of pure water, maybe this was just a more normal part of people's diets than I appreciate. I don't know.
Yeah. So, and I think this is part, to some degree, also part of the mechanism for permissibility is the potability of water. The potability of water, but needing something to drink, this chai nefesh need. I think that's a part of it. And I mentioned sort of that theoretical, which I don't think these people drinking these wines were thinking about, but he was allowing, just as bread and some other aspects that sort of maintain this division of as a bulwark against intermarriage. I think he is, he's like, maybe there's room. Maybe they misunderstood.
So is that it? Stam Yenam is now Heter Gamor. We're done.
Right. So he says, look, near Levitam, Hamikilim, Bidnudo, Shane, Shum, Devar, Lishtokim, Yain. So what about these places? It seems to me that the reason for these people, so he's not saying for him, for these lenient folks in these lands that they have only wine to drink. He's like, nobody Nobody should rely on my words. Kilo bati rak kimitara asher. I'm not trying to purify something that which is totally unpurifiable, as it were. He's like, no. That ki ani omer bidavar zeh shelo bati rak laharot kitzat panim hater avol olismoch ozed klal. Nobody should rely upon me. I'm just trying to provide some sort of theoretical support with regards to these wine drinkers.
Right. And he says, Kol shekein b'mekomo shel nagu b'hater. Certainly those who are not being noega heter, but tafsuha emes b'yadehem, and they are holding on to the truth in their hands. You know, the people who know what the real halacha is, that would be usher for them to change in such an instance like that.
I want to point out something that I think goes rather unremarked and I think is really important. So one of the things that he does a lot in Yoredeia, not so much in Orachaim, Choshem Mishpah, Ebenezer, something that is a lot in Yoredeia, and I don't, it's been years since I really did the research. He is huge on Minhagim, huge. He loves his Minhagim. That is super important to him. That's one of the biggest drivers for his writing of the Mapa on Rabbi Kaira Shulchan Aruch. So that's one piece of it. He's also, and so one of the key languages, this common refrain he uses is, Ein Lishnas. Like he doesn't want anybody to mess or otherwise change these Minhagim. They're important. And so this language, he's using sort of in a inverse way, which is he's not saying that, you know, we shouldn't change it, but he's like, they believe that they cannot change. He's like, no, they can't change it. And it's sort of it's a mirror image of how he perceives Minhag and the importance of it. And certainly for these places, these people and these Jews in these places, that this is an unchangeable practice of theirs.
So does the Rama ultimately accomplish his goal? How is his tshuva received by his contemporaries, by later poskim? It sounds like he's very much worried for how people are going to read this. So what ultimately happens?
Well, before we get to the reception history, one other piece he throws in some other stuff. And then sort of after he comes to all this, he also allows, what about people who are sick, cholim? And so he allows, and he has to do some wiggle work with Rishonim, who talk about how even for sick people, you're not allowed to have Gentile wine for them. But he says, look, for sick people who really need this, not for people who are just like a little bit weakened. If you're sick and you need this, I'll allow that. You know, he goes like a step further. He says, no, this is fine for these type of cholim. But in any event, really how he ends is v'chol ha-machmir tavo lav bracha v'chaim v'shalom. So, and that's actually a similar language that he uses in his mapa in the 123.1 in Yoredeia, that, you know, even, and I'm allowing leniency and I'm allowing all these things, but anyone who's stringent, tavo alav bracha, blessings should come upon
you. I always love when the Rama is self-referential to his chuvos.
yeah. So he's consistent in that matter. So that's sort of the end of it for him. As you mentioned, this has an afterlife, right? What's the reception history? So this is perhaps famously, as I mentioned earlier, perhaps one of the most famous instances of all of Jewish history of an internal censorship, that it gets excised from certain printings of his teshuvot. Because people not happy with it, and they are secondarily also concerned that it might be misread or misunderstood by people who say, well, Rabbi Yisraelis permits this, it's totally fine.
Yeah.
So they are concerned about this. Now, two further things. One is two further things that I actually learned from Professor Shapiro on the show. One was on the episode that he was a guest for the Jewish Drinking Show, was the first of which was Italian rabbis, not just Italian Jews, but Italian rabbis specifically wrote to permit drinking Gentile wine. I don't know if maybe the 18th, but definitely 19th, early 20th centuries. They very specifically permitted, and it was really the only time Orthodox rabbis have ever said that consuming Gentile wine is totally fine.
Carte blanche. That was it.
Yeah. So it's not just that the Italian rabbis themselves were drinking, they even wrote to permit it to the common Jews. So
which is kind of funny, because again, we're talking about, Catholicism, I think, is pretty prominent in Italy, is my understanding.
Right. So maybe intermarriage wasn't. I don't know what those social conditions were like, but maybe it was. Maybe the Italian rabbis were unconcerned with this regard and said, "Look, you know, wine's all around. We can drink."
So the Ramaz's greatest fear has become realized. In which, yeah. Even though as much as he tried to tell people, do not use as a blanket Hector, I've heard this a lot on the show. One of my favorite instances of this is the Sridi Eshan Kolisha, is that he has this whole tshuva where he's like, well, maybe Trikali, and then if it's only Zmiros when it's in a context of Kedusha, then maybe we could permit boys and girls singing together under specific conditions. And then all of a sudden, in many segments of modern Orthodoxy, it's like, wait, there's an Isser called Kolisha out there? I thought the Sridi Eshan said there's no Isser of Kolisha anymore. Oh, so, wow. So it's kind of like it's kind of a similar dynamic. So okay, so that's the Italian rabbis.
That's one piece of it. The other piece of it is in the late 20th century, the CJLS, the Conservative Jewish Law Standards Committee, they permitted it. They permitted Gentile wine just out and out. So and I haven't looked at that, but I don't know how well or closely they read Rabbi Isserles' Teshuva that we've covered, because he definitely wasn't trying, unless they were less concerned about intermarriage. I don't know. Definitely Tzarechian for me to go into it.
But I mean, on the list of things that they've permitted over the past few decades, I mean, right. I think if Stam Yenim was the worst thing, I think they'd be in a better place. But anyway.
So it does have a really colorful afterlife, like perhaps one of the most colorful afterlives of all teshuva history, really. So this is not an insignificant teshuva by any stretch of the imagination. And happily, it's a drinking text.
Wow. Anything else that you just want to leave our listeners with? Anything we should know about alcohol, about Purim, or just about the really cool work that you're doing in this sphere?
Well, thank you. So obviously people can check out jewishdrinking.com for loads and loads of resources. Obviously, I mentioned the Jewish Drinking Show having published over 150 episodes, obviously Purim and Pesach stuff. But, I know your listeners are big into teshuvot, shoot literature. We've covered multiple shoot just on that show alone. We also have resources for contemporary drinkers. There's clips. There's also other resources, not just video and audio, but also written resources and more. And if there's stuff you would like to see you don't see on the website, please feel free to reach out and let me know.
Okay, well, Rabbi Drew Kaplan, thank you so much for your time, and wishing you and all of your loved ones a Freilich and Purim.
Awesome, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates, and if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.